Answering your last-minute voting questions. Mainers are already voting in record numbers this election cycle. The number of absentee ballots turned in so far this year has surpassed the total number of votes cast in 2016. But with less than 2 weeks to go until Election Day, some voters still have questions. I'm Cindy Hahn. Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap joins us once again to answer any remaining questions about absentee ballots, ranked choice voting, election integrity, and more. We'll discuss voter turnout and how towns are handling ballots, the steps being taken to ensure a safe voting environment, and what the timetable looks like for when vote tallies may be done. We'll also squeeze in some questions about the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, the latest on the census, and more. Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap joins Maine Calling. But first, this news update. This is Maine Calling, and I'm your host, Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap is back to answer last-minute voting questions as we count down to Election Day. Secretary Dunlap, thank you so much for joining us again.
It's good to be back.
And as always, we welcome your questions and comments. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And a quick reminder that tonight at 8, we'll hear from the candidates for the 2nd Congressional District in our final Maine Public Your Vote 2020 debate series. We'll carry that on Maine Public Television, radio, and streaming at mainepublic.org. Secretary Dunlap, this is prime time for you, 12 days and counting to Election Day. What's the busiest part of all of this right now for you?
Well, we're really just trying to assist the towns in their preparations as they get ready to set up polling stations and begin processing of absentee ballots. The trajectory of absentee balloting is really pretty historic. I don't think we've ever seen turnout quite like what we've seen by absentee since the legislature changed the law to remove the requirement that you had to have a reason to get an absentee ballot. So basically what we call no excuse absentee balloting. That was 21 years ago. And prior to that time, you know, absentee balloting might constitute about 5% of the turnout of an election. And in recent years, we've seen that just grow and grow and grow to about 35% of aggregate turnout. I think in the primary in July, we saw about 60% of turnout was by absentee. And of course, the pandemic has changed everything. But right now, as of Monday afternoon, we ran the records. We had about 415,298 requests for absentee ballots. Now, to give you an economy of scale here, in the 2016 general election, the presidential cycle, we issued something like 250,000 absentee ballots. So we're already almost double that. And that is just an extraordinary show of citizenship by our fellow Mainers. So this is it's a pretty busy time for us right now.
Wow. So the tally of the ones that have come in, do you have that number too?
Yeah, so far we've had about 279,000 returned. That was about a 50,000 ballot jump from Friday to Monday. So they're coming in fast.
And are you surprised or were you expecting this and prepared for this?
Well, we kind of projected that this was going to be the case, that we could see, again, about a 60% of the turnout by absentee. We anticipated that could translate into as many as 600,000 absentee ballots. So we've kind of been prepared for it, but it's a little bit like preparing for a snowstorm, you know, and until it actually hits, it's hard to say whether or not you've done the right preparations, and it looks like we have.
Great. And as far as preparations go, what about the possibility of running out of ballots on Election Day?
We don't believe that we're going to run out of ballots. You know, we printed about 105% of the number of registered voters in the state of Maine. And if towns begin to run short and we don't have time to get them overruns, then they can make photocopies of ballots. We can authorize them to do that. So there's really no chance that a voter will show up at the polls and not be able to vote.
Okay. And what are the town clerks busy doing with those ballots right now that have come in? What can they start doing in the process in advance?
Under the governor's executive order, they can begin processing absentee ballots. And processing an absentee ballot is not exactly like processing a chicken, but there are parallels. So, you know, and they can start processing those. up to 7 days in advance of the election. So it's a public process, and what they do, of course, you have the applications that are filed by the voters to get the absentee ballot. They have to ask for it, and there's a paper application that accompanies every request. And then when the clerk issues the ballot, it is sent to the voter by whatever means they describe. They can have, you know, a third party deliver it for them and bring it back. They can have it mailed to them. They can go to the town hall and get it themselves. In the 30-day period before the election, they can even vote it there and just hand it back to the clerk. The clerk receives it, and then they'll log it in. They inspect it to make sure that all the elements have been followed, like they've signed the back flap. That's a really critical piece. And they log it in as accepted. And this year, which is a new feature on our website, voters can get onto the absentee ballot request service and type in their information and see where their ballot is, to see if it's been returned, if it's gotten back to the town clerk, and whether or not they've accepted it. It's great information for the voter to have. It gives them a lot of comfort knowing that everything has been completed. And then when they get into the processing component of it, again, it's a public process. They catalog these things in alphabetical order, and they pull out the ballot, and they'll announce, Cindy Hahn. And if there's, the people can watch, and then they open the envelope, and the ballots are scored and folded in such a way that when they're put into the ballot and taken out, you can't see how the voter voted. So you take the envelope and staple it to the application, and you keep that on file for about 6 months. And then you put the folded ballot in a pile with other ballots. And when you get to a certain point, you take all those ballots, you lay them out flat, and then you cast them. The tallies are not run until after 8 p.m. on election night, but they can start doing that the Tuesday before the election. And that's going to be really critical for the larger communities like Portland, which sent out something like 27,000 absentee ballots prior to the 30-day in-person window. So they're going to have a lot of ballots to process.
Okay, so the processing step is getting everything just teed up, ready to tally on election day, but no tabulating is happening before then.
No totals are run until after 8 p.m.
Okay, a little behind the scenes there. That's good. I did actually do the absentee ballot tracking, and it was really quick and easy, and confirmed that my ballot was received, so that's a great system.
Yep.
You mentioned about the signature on the envelope, and I understand that's one of the few things that a ballot can be rejected for, correct? Talk about some of the reasons that a ballot can be rejected and what some of the common things that you see are.
That's the most common reason, is that people forget to sign the back of the envelope. In fact, we've had it put on the drop boxes that we've been providing to towns, don't forget to sign the envelope. That's the connection between the voter and the ballot. Chain of custody is incredibly important to the integrity of the process, so that we can describe with authority who has handled the ballot from the moment it leaves a printing press to when it's finally marked and counted and sealed in a ballot box at the end of the night on election day. So, that's the key reason. If it shows up late, it will be rejected. Late is after 8 p.m. on election night. Has to be in the possession of the clerk by 8 p.m. Another reason to reject, curiously enough, is like say you mail your ballot the day before the election, and you're not sure it's going to get in on time, and you consult with the town clerk, and the town clerk says, come to the polls and vote. And you vote, and the clerk knows that you've now already voted. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that there's an extra mail run that comes in at 7:55. They would then reject your ballot because you can only submit one ballot. And that's something that, we encourage people to do this early rather than late. But we also acknowledge the fact that people actually are living very, very busy lives right now, especially in the time of the pandemic, and trying to figure out how to put food on the table and school and 100 other things, and that this rather bureaucratic process, simple as it is, it does have avenues for people to make mistakes. So we try to provide every vector that we can for the voter to make corrections to anything they may have gotten wrong. Like on the envelope signature component, we've told towns, if a ballot comes in without a signature on the envelope, give it a business day and try to track the voter down and let them know. And if you can't track them down, then that's when you reject the ballot in the system. the voter looks into the system and sees that their ballot's been rejected, well, then they can take the initiative and reach out to the town clerk and see what they can do to fix it. So we try to provide every avenue we can so the voter's voice can be heard.
Okay, so there is some degree to which the town clerks are following up when somebody has forgotten some basic step.
That's correct.
Okay. And you mentioned also, I guess, that up until 8 p.m. is the last time that an absentee ballot could come in and still be counted. So I think there are a lot of people who fall in that category that you were saying. They're not sure if it's received in time. They're wondering if they should vote in person just in case. And if they do that, there is a system in place to not count both votes. Is the onus on them to make sure that that's known, or do the clerks catch it one way or the other?
Either way, we keep track of every single ballot.
Okay.
And in fact, we've had a situation just this week. I had somebody call who had forgotten that they had requested an absentee ballot and went to their town hall to vote absentee in person and were told, you've already received an absentee ballot. And they didn't think they had. And they went home and they found it in a pile of mail.
Oh, okay. I know how that goes.
These are little fail safes. When I say we have a strict chain of custody, every step of the way is managed so that people get to vote, but they only get to vote once.
Okay. And until when can people still fill out an online request for an absentee ballot?
The deadline for getting an online request, and I don't think we really... I can't remember exactly what that deadline is. You caught me short, Cindy.
But you can send us to the website for answers, right?
Yes, that's right. Everything's on the website, maine.gov/SOS. We have a whole page there on the upcoming election, and it tells you precisely the deadlines. I can tell you it's 15 days before the election to send in a paper registration. If you've not registered to vote, let me slow down a little bit. If you have not registered to vote, you want to do this by mail, you should do it 15 days before the election. Of course, we're well within that now.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no deadline to register to vote. You can register to vote up to and including election day. In most places, that is actually at the polling station that you can register to vote. And you may say, well, I am registered to vote. But if you've moved since the last time you voted, you're going to need to update your voter registration because you have to vote in the town that you live in. Even if you've moved across town, you may be in a new district. So you'll want to get that taken care of. Pretty simple process.
Okay. So much of this is happening. I'm just curious how towns are handling all this staffing and work of processing ballots and also getting their spaces to be COVID safe and having enough workers for all of the extra work this year.
We learned an awful lot in the work that we did for the primary, and we had never done anything like this before. And that was the operative question that was swirling in the air when the pandemic hit and the governor declared the state of civil emergency in mid-March and the legislature adjourned a month early. How do you go about running an election in the middle of a virus pandemic? So we just cleaved very closely to the CDC guidelines. We procured personal protective equipment for all poll workers, including plexiglass barriers at the ballot clerk stations, et cetera. We spaced out the voting booths so they're at least 6 feet apart. The ones that you stand at the four-way stations, we're only allowing like one voter at a time to use those. They're periodically sanitized. We provided single-use pens to minimize what people touch. We strongly encourage people to vote by absentee. We strongly encourage them, if they're coming to the polls, to wear face covering. They can't be turned away at the polls if they don't have a face covering, but we ask them to move along as quickly as they can.
Mm-hmm.
When we watched the results of after the primary was done and over with, after July 14th, the weeks that followed, we saw no spike in infections. Now, what that tells us is that the guidelines from CDC and Dr. Shaw, if you follow them, you have a strong chance of completely defeating the coronavirus. And we've seen plenty of other systems and situations in the state of Maine where guidelines were not followed and they've had some problems. So that gave us a great playbook for November. So we're sort of following the same game plan. You know, we've provided personal protective equipment, courtesy, by the way, of Flowfold and L.L. Bean. They've actually provided all the face coverings.
Oh, local companies. Yeah. That's great.
And not only that, but as we go through this whole business with the drop boxes, drop boxes are brand new. This is something that states that do all mail have made good use of. And so we've been following that script. But all the companies that make drop boxes are way, way overbooked. You know, they're back ordered until sometime near the end of the year. So it is very difficult for communities to get drop boxes. The governor gave us some great assistance, and Southern Maine Community College came up with a design that a company in Maine has been producing drop boxes for about 60 towns that asked for them. We're covering much of the cost through the Federal CARES Act money. That's been a great innovation, too, to help people give them one more vector to return their absentee ballot, again, without risk of exposure. So these are all things that we're doing again for November. We are going to have the polling stations open. So people can update their voter registration. There's the accessible voting system. But again, also, we got a request from the Disability Rights Center right before the primary, and we've made some modifications to our military and overseas system that allows for electronic transmission of ballots to include being able to include people with disabilities in Maine to get an absentee ballot electronically and use computer software to have the ballot read to them and allow them to mark it and return it. So again, the focus here is very singular. We want to make sure that every voter who wishes to participate in this process can do so with the confidence that their ballot will be counted accurately and fairly, and that they can participate without fear of the pandemic. And we were able to do that in July, and we're on the trajectory to be successful in November as well.
That's great. And what can you tell Maine voters who might be concerned about polling place security issues and things that we hear about happening elsewhere, like voter intimidation?
Well, that is a national concern. I think it's less of a concern in Maine, you know, because Maine is really one big small town. We have not heard of any plans for groups to try to do some citizen policing of the polls, as it were. And, you know, you've heard about militia groups in other states planning on staking out the polls. You know, we haven't heard about anything like that. We have underscored that the warden of a polling place has absolute control of the polling place out to 250 feet from the entrance to the polling place. And they have the legal authority to have people removed by law enforcement and actually detained for the duration of Election Day if they cause a problem and refuse to leave. Historically, we haven't seen anything like that. And even though this is a very, very high-stakes election and there's an intense amount of interest in it, and, you know, there are concerns about how the process works, we have not seen any indication that there's going to be anything uncivil happening at the polls. And if there is, we'll be prepared to swiftly deal with it.
Okay, well, we have a question about that, actually, but we'll get to that after the break. We're just going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com. AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots. AARP.org/MaineVotes. And MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy.
The first debate was chaos.
The new question Supreme is, Court Justice, the radical question, left.
Will you shut up, man?
Listen.
The second one was canceled. Now former Vice President Biden and President Trump face off one last time before election night. I'm Ari Shapiro. Join NPR tonight for special live coverage of the presidential debate, plus recaps and analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
And that's coming up tonight at 9 on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television.
Jennifer Rooks here. Thursday night, Maine Public hosts a debate among the candidates running for Maine's 2nd Congressional District, incumbent Jared Golden and challenger Dale Crafts. Tune in to Maine Public Television, Maine Public Radio, or the Maine Public website to learn where the candidates stand on the issues. The 2nd Congressional District Candidate Debate, live Thursday night at 8 on Maine Public Radio, Television, and online at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, we are talking with Secretary of State Matt Dunlap about the lead up to Election Day and to get answers to your questions about voting and more. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And Matt Dunlap, you were talking about that distance outside the polling area, and we have an email from Carl about that. He says, in Presque Isle, political folks stand just outside the doors of the polling place. Where is the 250-foot distance measured from? I'm concerned that the line to vote will go out the door and folks will have to put up with the politicians while in line.
Good question. And it's actually 250 feet from the entrance to the polling place. It's a circumference, if you will. And candidates can be there. Now, we've also issued guidance about social distancing with candidates. They have to wear face coverings. And also the rules are they can't ask you to vote for them. They can't tell you what office they're running for. Basically, they can say, I'm Matt Dunlap. Thanks for voting today, or I'm a friend of Matt Dunlap, or I'm Matt Dunlap's astrologer. Thank you for voting today. And it's of limited utility this year because I think we're going to have an awful lot less foot traffic at the polls because we've had so many people voting by absentee. But the question that Carl follows up with is, what if there's a line because of social distancing? Is actually a very timely question because we have given clerks instruction that if 8 o'clock strikes and you have a line out the door, and in some areas you may have, because of the number of people who are allowed in the polling station at a time, you might have a line out the door. And we've told people, be prepared for that. You know, the weather in November can be a little bit unpredictable. They should dress accordingly. And if you have a line into the parking lot, that an election worker at 8 o'clock should go stand at the end of that line, and that will constitute the end of the line. And therefore, anyone who is in line at the time that the polls close will be able to still go in and vote.
Okay. Thanks for that question, Carl. We have a lot of questions coming in, but I did want to get to ranked choice voting. I know you've already explained how this works till you're blue in the face, but many people are still confused. And there's additional confusion out there with mailers going out explaining it inaccurately. So could you just start with maybe what you should not do with ranked choice voting? What makes your ballot invalid?
Okay, so this is actually a very simple process, and it has been confused by some of the concerns about, you know, what constitutes a valid vote. The number one question that we have always gotten about ranked choice voting, and by the way, all the information is on the website, including an animated cartoon to show how it works.
With you as the little animated explainer, right?
Yeah, and you can tell it was done in-house because they gave me a little bit more hair than I really have in my cartoon avatar.
But it's really good. I like that video.
It's very popular. But the number one question we get is, do I have to rank my choices or can I just vote for one candidate? And the answer is absolutely yes. The voter controls their ballot. You have a five-way race right now for president. If you only want to vote for one candidate and you want nothing to do with the other four, you can do that. Now, what would invalidate your ballot is if you chose to give all five candidates a first-place vote. We can't determine voter intent. If you only like one candidate and you choose to give them the rankings 1 through 5, that does not invalidate your vote. That will count. Of course, it only counts once. And if your candidate makes it through each round to the very end, that first place vote follows them. So that's been where there's been a lot of confusion because of some of the mailings that have gone out that said that's the only way that your ballot will count. Is not true. You can rank your choices, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, ranking for each candidate. You can vote for just one candidate. You can vote for two candidates. You can vote for three candidates. You can skip a ranking. You can start at second place. All of this is valid. So the voter, like I say, does control their ballot up to the point where we cannot discern what their intentions are. And that's like if they were to give one candidate a first place vote, and the other four a second place vote, each one of them got second place, then that those second place choices would be invalidated because we can't determine what you really mean. You know, who do you really want? So ranked choice voting is very simple. It's a grid-style ballot. We've used it now for a couple of years, and it's been pretty successful so far. So we don't anticipate any major difficulties in November.
Okay, and I understand also on that website there are sample ranked choice ballots filled out so that people can kind of see examples of what the do's and don'ts are.
That's right. It's not just a narrative. There actually are visual aids to help you see what those valid and invalid ballots look like.
Okay, so just pay attention to what's invalid. Don't copy what you see, right?
Right.
As I understand it, it all boils down to don't try to game the system. I think when people are doing this thing with number ones across the board or whatever, they're trying to mess with it a little bit. So I guess you just vote number one for who you like the best, and if you want to rank the other ones, just rank them accordingly.
Exactly. And if you, you know, vote for a candidate that's eliminated in the first round, what does that mean? It means the same thing as it would in a plurality election. Mm-hmm. You gave your one vote to a candidate who did not prevail. So there is really no difference.
Okay. We will go to a caller now. Tony is calling from Milo. Hi, Tony. What's your question?
Hi. Well, I was just wondering what happens if you're in the line at 8 p.m. And is that the same everywhere? If, you know, are the rules different from town to town?
No, this is our guidance, Tony, to all the towns, that if you have a line outside or a line inside, that an election worker should stand at the end of the line. So if the voter in good faith has gotten to the polls before the close at 8 p.m., they will be allowed in to vote.
Okay. Is that do the trick, Tony, or do you still have another question? Okay.
No, that's good. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for calling. And we also have a question here from Peggy, an email from Peggy. My dear friend had to leave the country as her mom was dying. She sent for an absentee ballot, thinking that she would be back in the States by November 3rd, but sadly she will not. She and I want to know if I vote for her and she gives me instructions who and what to vote for. Can I do this somehow?
Peggy would wind up in jail if she did that. Oh. That would be a felony. Do not mark another voter's ballot. What Peggy's friend should do is contact us, and we can set her up with the MOVE Act UOCAVA system where she can get a ballot electronically if she's overseas. We will help her with that. But Peggy should not mark another voter's ballot.
Okay. Is there a similar system for others who may be not overseas, but they somehow can't fill it in time or do what they need to do?
The electronic transmission system is really only for overseas voters. We don't have a mechanism to do that domestically. And part of that is logistically. You know, we manage all those ballots going out and coming in centrally here in the Secretary of State's office. And we just hand off the tabulation totals to the towns for their final tabulation. And so we would not have the capacity to do this for everybody. And we don't have a system set up for the towns to manage it. So if somebody is in a situation where they have gotten an absentee ballot and say they had to go to California before the ballot arrived and they're not sure they're going to be back in time, they should probably call their town clerk and see what their options are. If somebody at home could forward it to them where they are in California and they could express mail it back or something like that. Time is an issue here now because we're 12 days out from the election. And we always hear these stories, by the way, Monday before the election. And I got really interested in this problem, especially with overseas voters, before we had these processes, when a former colleague of mine who was teaching in Pakistan had requested their absentee ballot 90 days for the election, and it showed up the day before the election in Pakistan, and there was no mechanism for them to return it. And so, you know, that's something we've done a lot of work on here over the last 10 years to ensure that people abroad, especially folks in the military, you know, somebody on a guided missile cruiser in the Persian Gulf, they only get mail once in a while. And so this system really, really helps them participate in the democracy that they're defending.
Good to know. Okay. We have an email from Lexine, and this is a sort of long one. I hand-carried my ballot, as well as my husband's ballot, to our town office on October 9th. I had to sign an affidavit saying I was my husband's spouse. The next week, I looked at the state website to see if our ballots had indeed been approved, and our ballots were both accepted. Although I am active in three campaigns doing phone banking and postcard writing, I do not receive any mail reminding me to vote. However, my husband continues to receive large reminders on a daily basis that ask him to please remember to vote. Why is he still receiving these notices, and why do I never receive any reminders?
That's a really good question, and along that same line, it's a good point. We've gotten a lot of complaints this year about repeated mailings from various organizations, including the political parties, that have voter registration reminders for people who are already registered to vote, absentee ballot request forms. They're the official state form, and sometimes pre-filled with names of people who don't live at that address. It's old information. We had one really heartbreaking one brought to our attention the other day where a family keeps getting election mail in the name of a family member who passed away quite a few years ago, and it's sort of re-traumatizing to them every time they see this piece of mail. So we don't control that, and the organizations that do it, especially like there's this organization called the Center for Voter Information out of Washington, D.C. They're a legitimate nonprofit. They're trying to encourage people to vote. But we don't know where they're getting their list from. They're not getting it from us. We suspect it's probably a voter file that was part of some old campaign from years ago that hasn't been updated in many years. And that's where a lot of that inaccurate information comes from, and also repetitive information, because more than one organization is doing this. And, you know, right now in this particular cycle, we're actually at my house in Middle Street in Old Town getting about three deliveries of mail a day, and it's mostly political mail.
Yeah, so I can relate to that. And just one person in our household of five keeps getting a lot of it targeted at him, so we don't know how that worked either. But okay, here's another question from John. Are there regulations for how absentee ballots are stored once we hand them over until they are counted on election day? I asked at my town office and was not reassured with the answer.
Well, they have to be secured, and that means a little something different in every town, because no two town offices are configured exactly the same way. You know, some towns have vaults. Some towns have safes. But when you have a volume of absentee ballots, you know, of maybe 10, 12, 20,000 ballots, it's hard to put them in a strong box. You know, you're not going to be able to fit those in there.
Mm-hmm.
So at the very minimum, they should be kept under lock and key, with very limited access to the key. You know, it should be only the town clerk that has access to the storage area where the absentee ballots are being kept. Whether that's a storage room or a safe or a strong box or even ballot boxes, those are tamper-proof. They're padlocked. We don't encourage those to be used that way, but if they have nothing else, they do have to be secured.
Okay, I think some of these questions coming in, everybody's seeking reassurance, and I guess that's the climate we're in right now with this election. This is a Facebook question from Karen. She says, I would like to know how you can tell that your absentee ballot was actually counted. I took mine to my local office. It was accepted, but then what? I checked the state's website to also confirm it was accepted, but then what I want to know is if it was opened and actually counted. How can we find this out?
Well, everything is accounted for. And this is something, I know there are a lot of questions about this type of process. And when I talk about chain of custody, you know, this has been built very carefully by the legislature over many, many years of real life experience. Who handles a ballot? We account for every single ballot. And this is a question we get a lot. And actually, one of the questions that's very persistent from election to election is, Mr. Secretary, is it true that absentee ballots are only counted if it's a close election?
Hmm.
Well, no, that's not true. We count every single ballot, and we account for every single ballot. So you have the mythical town of East Wagon Wheel, and they get 1,000 ballots from the printer. They have to actually do an inventory of their ballots. Now, some of those are going to be sent out absentee. So we're going to say that they're going to send out 300 absentee ballots. 250 come back. Maybe some portion of that 50 that don't come back actually show up to vote in person. And then maybe 500 people show up in person to vote. You match up all those numbers checked off on the incoming voter list against the inventory of of blank ballots and spoiled ballots, rejected ballots, and cast ballots, and it has to equal the same number. So you'll know mathematically that your ballot has been counted. The envelopes and applications are kept for 6 months after the election as part of the post-election cleanup that we do. You know, we enter in the voter participation histories into the central voter registration system. But the real work for election officials, by the way, really starts at 8 p.m. on election night, because then all that work has to happen to account for every single ballot. So there's no mystery as to what happens to ballots. It's all accounted for.
Okay, good to know. And we have a lot more questions coming in, but we're just going to take another quick break right now. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the law offices of Joe Bornstein, who believe that voting rights are the cornerstone of democracy. Learn more at vote.org/state/Maine. AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots. AARP.org/MaineVotes. And MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management, and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy.
The worst fire in Farmington's history took place on October 22, 1886, and virtually wiped out the Maine village. The Great Fire, as it was called, was said to have leveled 33 houses, 19 stores, 3 churches, 2 hotels, the county jail, and the post office. While the local telegraph operator sent SOS messages to surrounding towns, local firefighters tried unsuccessfully to battle the blaze. Lewiston in Portland quickly sent firefighting equipment on freight trains, which proved to turn the tide against the fire. Their rapid action saved much of the remaining town. The fire is believed to have been started by a spark from a locomotive on the nearby narrow gauge railroad.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Dean Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine!
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap joins us to talk about ballots and voting and answer your questions. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And Matt, I just wanted to ask you whether you have any projection for what results we might actually know by election night, late that night.
Yeah, I think we'll have a pretty good handle that night, assuming that early processing goes well of absentee ballots. We should have a pretty strong idea. If we're going to go to rankings, we'll know, probably either election night or the next morning, depending on how long it takes to get this information in. And that's going to really be predicated on how swiftly a lot of these absentee ballots can be processed ahead of time. You know, I think in the primary, the city of Portland processed something like 17,000 absentee ballots over 4 days, because now they have an extra 3 days, and I know they're going to be very busy. But Portland's not alone. You know, Lewiston has a lot of absentee ballots out, so does Bangor, even smaller communities like Augusta and Waterville. I think even in Old Town, there's close to 2,000 absentee ballots. So there's a lot to be done in the run-up to the election, and assuming that goes well, we should know in pretty short order what the results are going to be looking like.
Okay, that brings me to a Facebook question from Stephanie. Are volunteers allowed and needed to process absentee ballots? If so, can Maine residents volunteer in other towns if their town doesn't need assistance? Should interested folks contact town clerks to inquire about volunteer opportunities?
Yes to all of that.
Okay.
If you are interested in being a poll worker and helping out in this election cycle, we haven't heard of any systemic issues with towns being dramatically short of poll workers, but this is something we talked about a lot prior to the primary, because many poll workers come from the demographics of retired people, and that's precisely who you don't want in a congregate setting in the global pandemic. So a lot of folks have stepped up. And you know, the question I've gotten in almost every public event I've spoken to, usually through Zoom or some other electronic means, what about poll workers? You know, what are we going to do? It's like, well, if you want to help, you can talk to your town clerk. So contact your town clerk, see if they could use some additional help. And even if they don't, they'll take your name, because there's always a possibility that something goes wrong and somebody can't show up on election day and you could be asked to come and fill in. A lot of the work that is done is manual work, and that frees up the clerk and the registrar and others who have real subject matter knowledge to work on maybe some of the judgment calls around things like voter registration, that sort of thing on election day. So I strongly, and yes, you can work in other towns, and the governor's executive order expands that. So if you are in, like, say, and I always pick on Newport because it's in Penobscot County, but it borders Somerset County. So if you're in Somerset County and they need some help in Newport, abutting county residents can go into the other county and assist at the polls.
Okay, we had a show on the youth vote the other day, and one of the young people who called in was 17 years old and is going to be a poll worker. So is there a minimum age for helping out?
Actually, the law says they either have to be a registered voter or be pre-registered. And pre-registration is a relatively new phenomenon, and we're going to see a lot more of it because the legislature passed an automatic voter registration law last year that allows, like, a 16-year-old, when they get their driver's license, they can agree to have their information that they provided for their license ported over to the voter file. So they'd be in a pending status. And the law has been in the books for about 10 years or so. I think it was the USM's president, Glenn Cummings, actually sponsored the legislation that allowed someone who was 17 to register and participate in a primary election if they're going to be 18 by the November election. So someone who is pre-registered at 17 can work at the polls. You have to be a registered voter to work at the polls or pre-registered to vote.
Okay, we'll go to a call now from Betsy calling from Knox. Hi, Betsy. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, thank you so much. And Matt, just thank you for everything you do. Everyone in Maine should be able to feel really good about their vote counting because of all the work that you and your office do.
Well, thank you.
The caller that called about the absentee ballots, I wonder if she's confused about challenged ballots, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about challenged ballots in close elections. And I'm going to hang up. Thank you.
Okay, challenge ballots are sort of a one-off process, and the challenge ballot process is also being applied to some of those defects on absentee ballots. The best way to describe it is the way I'm most familiar with, and that is voter registration. So, and it would follow the same trajectory for a challenged absentee ballot. Now, you have to be registered in order to vote, and we have Election Day registration. So let's just say there are people out there who are just sort of eschewing the whole process. And then on Election Day, they said, everybody at work is talking about how important this is, so I'm going to go vote. So they work a double shift. They get out of work at 7:30. They get to the polls at 7:45, and they want to participate. Well, they don't have their wallet with them. They don't have anything with their address on it. And can they vote? Because you have to show proof of identity and proof of residency in order to register. Well, yes, they can vote. And the law allows for a process whereby their registration is filled out as best they can. They are given a ballot, is given a secret number on a piece of removable tape, and it's called a challenged ballot. And they vote the ballot. The ballot's cast and counted. And then after the election, and the same would run true on a challenged absentee. Like, say they take the person in California who forgot to sign their envelope. You contact them. They say there's no way we can get one back in time. So they process it as a challenged ballot. So after the election, for the person who's tried to register to vote, the registrar follows up, says, okay, now you come in and finish the process. And they get their ID, their proof of residency. Well, let's just say there's a recount, a close election. The recount supervisor will announce at the recount that there is a challenged ballot with a secret number in this election. Be on the lookout for it. And if the registrar is on their toes, they will have already completed the process. They can verify that the voter is registered and qualified. They take the secret number off, and the ballot is shuffled in and counted as part of the final tabulation. If they can't make that determination, and the ballot remains segregated and is not part of the final tabulation if they cannot ascertain the qualifications of the voter. So the challenge ballot process, it's completely different from what you hear in other states with provisional ballots, which are not counted unless the voter can determine, can show to the election official the determination of their eligibility. So it's a good process that preserves the rights of the voter.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question, Betsy. Here's an email saying, I voted by absentee ballot. However, I noticed that my first name was spelled wrong, so I put a line through it and printed the correct spelling next to it. I also signed the envelope as instructed, and I dropped it off at town hall, and the clerk said she'd correct it in the system and that I didn't need a new ballot. I want my vote to count, and I do not want to be accused of voter fraud. Did I do the right thing?
Absolutely, she did the right thing. Like, you know, the voter is in control of their identity, if nothing else. And, you know, the process that we use to enter in voter registrations is a largely automated process, but there is still some subject to error. So we take a voter registration card, and it's either manually entered by the registrar or it's scanned, and we use a program to convert that handwritten information into data. And sometimes there are some errors. But, yeah, you absolutely want to make sure your name is in the system correctly.
Okay, another clarification question, email from Mocha. I went to my town office, I'm down east, on Tuesday to register to vote as I had moved a little while back and hadn't gotten around to it yet. I was told the cutoff date was the 19th for registering and that now I can't register until Election Day. This confuses me because I thought people could register anytime up until Election Day.
She is correct. She can go register, and if she goes to the town office, she should have them give us a call to clarify that. The cutoff on the 19th was for mail-in registrations, not in-person registrations. So they should go to the town office. The town officials here, let me just be very clear, they're not incompetent. But, you know, your town clerks are not only running the election, they're collecting taxes, they're licensing dogs, they're selling hunting licenses. This is a very busy time for that this year. So, in many small towns, the town clerk is also the town manager, the director of public works, and probably wears several other hats on top of things. So they have an awful lot going on. And if you feel like a mistake has been made, you're doing the absolute right thing by asking. And the reality is, yes, you can register to vote up to and including Election Day.
Speaking of wearing lots of hats, I still wanted to get to a motor vehicle question to you before we do. We still have other callers and questions. But motor vehicle, there's a new registration executive order right now calling for people to register their vehicles. Do you want to summarize that for people who've been putting it off?
Sure. Well, you know, of course, when the pandemic hit back in March, we shut down our offices. We had a bit of a scare. We thought maybe we had an infection in our main office. Turned out that tested negative. We closed all the branch offices, and a lot of town offices were closed too, at least to public traffic. Well, how do you register your vehicle? If you're in a town that uses rapid renewal, all those mailings are put together by our staff, and they weren't there. I will say that we did have one of our staff go in early April and processed about 6,000 rapid renewal registration forms in about a week, which is just a heroic demonstration of efficiency. What the governor did under the executive order at the time was to extend the validity of registrations and licenses for up to 30 days after the expiration of the declared civil emergency. Well, in the meantime, town offices have opened. Our offices have reopened. At first, they're by appointment only, and then we reopened it to walk-in traffic. And there's really no reason to not register your vehicle at this point. And, your local community could use, winter's coming, they have to buy sand and salt, and the excise taxes that you pay on your vehicles help support that. So in talking with the governor's office, we've seen a sharp decrease in the number of vehicles that are out on the road that are not currently registered. But we're trying to get back to normalcy and also trying to manage the traffic. And that's why we have that sort of cascade of deadlines that are on our website talking about when you purchased a vehicle or when your registration expired, what those deadlines should look like. And if you purchased a vehicle between January 1st and March 15th, or which the registration expired before March 1st, you ought to go ahead and get it registered because you've had the opportunity to do that now for a couple of months. If you bought one in the middle of the pandemic, you should get it registered by December 18th, or if the registration expired anytime between March 1st and May 31st, you ought to get it done by the 18th of December. And then if you've purchased one between June 1st and September 30th, or if the registration expired at the same time, you ought to get it registered by February 16th. That allows us to manage the foot traffic that we're going to see both in town offices and in motor vehicle offices, and also gets everybody back on a normal platform around vehicle registrations.
Okay, thanks. And yet another hat of yours, the census, just a real quick question. That ended early nationally, and so what did Maine census returns look like by the end of the count?
We were close to 99%, so it was an extraordinary effort. Once we were able to get the enumerators, the in-person enumerators, out to those areas that don't have good internet service, and we hadn't gotten a lot of mail returns, the participation rate more than doubled. And that's a real credit to the people that came to work for the census and get that work done.
Okay. Great. And here is a nice email from Jody. I want to thank Matt Dunlap for his efforts these past years on behalf of the voters and drivers of Maine. His ability to communicate clearly and be accessible to the people has inspired confidence and goodwill. I wish him all the best as he leaves office. Which brings me to ask you, in the last minute or so that we have, what's next for you? This is your seventh and final term as Maine Secretary of State.
That's still a little bit up in the air. I've had a few inquiries, got a couple irons in the fire, but frankly, I've been so focused. I have not been so busy since my first year as Secretary of State, and many days I don't get home till sometimes 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night. Sometimes I listen to Maine Calling on the way home.
Good way to spend your time.
So I don't know exactly what's next yet, but I'm not afraid. I've worked as a commercial cook. I've worked in a textile factory. I've worked in restaurants. I've worked in printing operations, in academic offices, and in government. And it's always a new adventure that's very exciting. So I've been really proud to have the people around me that have enabled us to all succeed. And I'm just grateful for the opportunity to help people. That's why I got in the business, and it's been an extraordinary opportunity.
Well, you're certainly going out with a bang with this historic election.
Well, for sure. And I think the discussion after the election will be how it all turned out and not anything about the process. That's our goal. And my goal in the next year is for everyone to forget who the last Secretary of State, who was that kind of bald guy that used to be in the office. That's my goal.
Well, great. And we're going to talk to you again on Election Day. So still more excitement to come with you on Maine Calling. Thank you so much for joining us today, Secretary Matt Dunlap, longtime Secretary of State for the state of Maine. And a reminder that tonight at 8, Maine Public's Jennifer Rooks, Mal Leary, and Steve Missler host a debate featuring the candidates for the 2nd Congressional District, incumbent Jared Golden and challenger Dale Crafts. You can tune in at Maine Public Television, radio, and at mainepublic.org. Today's sound engineer was Lucy Suchek, and this program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Visit our website, mainecalling.org, for links to past programs and resources mentioned on the show. And while there, you can also sign up for our podcast. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.